Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's more than a year since September 11, 2001, but the effects of that day continue to drive international relations. Case in point, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Americans can't forget that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. Still today, the relationship is poisoned by deep suspicions, by deep divisions over Middle East policy, and by cultural and social schisms that seem wider than they have in 30 years. The old trade of American money for Saudi oil remains the primary link. But now there's a potential war with Iraq. The Saudi foreign minister is saying his kingdom may, he hasn't said it will, may refuse to let the U.S. use its airspace and bases to attack Baghdad. So it would seem to be a hopeless time to encourage new links, new investment. But that's precisely the job that Prince Abdullah bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud has. He's a nephew of King Fahd and chairman of the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority. Connection listeners, we are continuing our series looking at nations in the Gulf. Today we invite you to join us for your sense of American-Saudi relations. What's wrong and what can be fixed? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And also joining us on the program today, Gregory Gause III. He heads up the Middle East Studies program at the University of Vermont, and he's made U.S.-Saudi relations one of his areas of specialization. He joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Welcome, Gregory.
Good morning.
I'll chat with you in half a sec. Prince Abdullah's here with me in the studio. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you very much.
Let me start with you, if I can. Use this weekend from the Saudi foreign minister that no, the U.S. should not or could not use Saudi bases in an attack on Iraq. A correction in this morning's paper, again, from the foreign minister saying maybe under certain conditions the bases could be used, seems to point to some indecision there. How do you read it?
Well, I just read it this morning. It seems that everybody is waiting to see the details of the U.N. resolution. And continuous discussions are taking place. There is no doubt that the Saudis are facilitating as much as possible for the fight against terrorism. The question with regard to Iraq is a lot more complex. We have made statements in the past saying that only through United Nations and international consensus that any action like this should take place. And that we'll play our part. We have always played our part when it was necessary to coordinate with the United States on strategic issues to do with the Middle East. In the past, we did not need any security agreements with the United States. We did not need a prenuptial agreement. We did not even need a marriage because we were so much in love with each other on the major issues. Now, things have changed in the sense that there were a lot of local issues that had to be clarified, and the horrendous travesty that took place in New York obviously made things a lot more complicated for both sides and allowed extremists, you know, to take the lead in front of the public opinion. And that is unfortunate.
One of the things that we know is that public opinion polls show us that both in the United States and in Saudi Arabia, more than half the population in both countries say that they are distrustful of the other nation. What you can do for us today, I hope, is give us a sense, a little bit of an insider's look at how America is viewed in Saudi Arabia. I raised the question of the bases because it did seem to me perhaps a useful way of looking at a debate that exists in Saudi Arabia between the hardliners who say, you know, we take nothing but criticism from Americans. Why should we continue with this relationship? And others who think that a course of moderation is the best way of going. What's your sense of how that debate is where the strength in that debate is at this point?
The government is very clear on the importance of good Saudi-American relations. The relationship has been for 70 years It had been one of the most respectable relations or relationships between a superpower and a third world country. It started due to business and oil. It grew into educational, cultural, and other activities, and, of course, the convergence of strategic views in the 70s when the Soviet threat appeared above the table. I don't think the basics have changed. We must not allow extremists, and certainly not terrorists, to do damage, otherwise they will succeed. And it is unfortunate that in times like this, where there is the excitement of a crisis, many people take the lead in public opinion, voicing some things that are bordering on the extremist, and they give the wrong impression. And of course, the terrorist intended to use 15 Saudis who were kids with a mixed-up background to drive a wedge between the host of the Muslim holy places and eventually between the major Arab countries who had good relations with the Americans and the Muslim world, which is 20% of the world population, so to soften their targets for their takeover. They were really driven. We were the ultimate target. And of course, we were so traumatized by what happened in New York and the involvement of people who claim to represent our faith, to have recruited 15 kids.
But it goes a little bit beyond that, doesn't it, Prince? I mean, you have, we have considerable evidence to show that a lot of money from people in Saudi Arabia funded the Taliban, that money from Saudi Arabia funded Osama bin Laden long after he began his Al-Qaeda campaign, and that hundreds of young Saudi men fought with the Taliban. I mean, it's not right to say it was just those 15 and they were an aberration. There are.
No, and I agree with you that it's a lot more in one sense, but remember, bin Laden and those that went to Afghanistan, they originally went to fight against the Soviets with American and Saudi money. It was a joint operation. Later on, well-organized terrorists decided to use that as a base. The Taliban, by the way, to begin with, were the only ones who brought security to Afghanistan. Only later on, under the influence of terrorists, they changed track when their negotiations with Americans broke down. We had bin Laden was kicked out of our country, his nationality was withdrawn, and all the organizing, as the investigation seems to be proving, have been from outside Saudi Arabia. If people had used certain charity donations or centers that received charity donations and tricked them into, you know, working under their umbrella or some money trickle, then, you know, that could have happened. But, you know, there are certain causes that are well-funded publicly in the United States and other places that in some other countries are seen as terrorists. And it's always very difficult. It's very confusing. But certainly there was no way that Saudis intended to fund terrorism because we have never had any problems with the Americans. We were very close to the Americans. Only in the last 3 or 4 years, there was strong emotional reaction to the Israeli policy in Palestine and what seems to be as tacit support by the American administration. But this is more of an anti-American policy thing than a pro-Bin Laden thing.
Let's bring Gregory Gause into the conversation. Gregory, you spend a lot of time looking at the way that these two countries get along. Earlier in the conversation, Prince Abdullah talked about the relationship as a marriage. Do you see it in that term, and one that's having some difficulties?
Well, I think that maybe for the last 12 years it's been a marriage, since the Gulf War. Relations have been much closer at a military level and at a public level. I mean, that's not to say that relations were bad before, but there was always a little bit of distance on the political and military side between Saudi Arabia and the United States, and I think that that's the way the Saudis like it, and the Americans live with that too. We were very close in terms of economics and oil. We were very close, as Prince Abdullah said, in terms of education. Thousands, tens of thousands of Saudis came and studied in the United States. But on the military side, we sold weapons, we trained, but we didn't have forces there. We were over the horizon. That was the expression. Since the Gulf War, we've been in the backyard. And I think that that has created some amount of tension. As Prince Abdullah says, American policy on Arab-Israeli issues is not something that most Saudis like. But if the United States isn't present in your country, if it's not in your face, so to speak, you might be able to live with that a little bit better. I think that the intensity of the relationship in the last 12 years has been such that it has created these tensions. And of course, as Prince Abdullah said, September 11 just brought them to the surface in both countries.
And this has brought all this writing, Gregory, in the United States from the Friedmans and other commentators saying, time to call this relationship. Time to say that there are too many flaws in the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Too many things that are going unsaid in this marriage.
Well, there have been things that have been unsaid, and I think that September 11th has brought them up, and we're saying them. And the Saudis, and at least from what I can tell, in Saudi Arabia, more people are talking about these issues also, which could be one of the unintentional good effects of this whole horrible business. And so I think that the overall sense of the relationship on both the American and the Saudi sides is that the more public opinion in both sides looks at this relationship, the less they like it. And this has always been a relationship at an elite level based very much on common interests and important common interests that are still there about the world economy and about regional security in the Gulf area and in the Middle East as a whole. And I think that to the extent that we get back to those common interests, we still have a basis for a good relationship. But undoubtedly, it's going to go through a few more bumps. It's going to go through some bumps on Iraq, and it's going to go through some bumps on Arab-Israeli issues.
We think there is a lot of extreme opinions on both sides for their own domestic reasons. And many would like to spoil the special link. Some people would like not to see any Arab countries having good relations with Americans. We in Saudi Arabia go to the Americans and talk as friends. We don't get economic aid from the Americans. We don't need security arrangements or bases. We don't live on, the government does not live on U.S. government protection or money. And we've been friends on solid ground, and we want to be friends, and we'll continue. If we allow extremists who are sort of fishing in muddy waters, as we say.
But Gregory's saying, though, this special relationship that you're talking about, these special links, are links just between the elites, between the royal family and those in the United States with the money to buy Saudi oil?
I don't think so. There is a lot of things, and there will be a lot of things. The Saudis are one of the biggest investors in the United States markets. The American companies have been doing investments there. We have very good feeling for Americans. Most Saudis like the Americans. They came here to study because the Americans are friendly, warm-hearted.
Though open. Fewer of them are here now than were here before.
Well, we must not let that continue to be so. We must increase contact and dialogue. I think the basics have not changed. The big difference was really the Soviet link or the factor in the Middle East. And, of course, the Saudis are the only ones can go to the Americans and talk frankly about what people think in the Middle East about the U.S. policy in that area. And there are many Americans, unfortunately, who want to see that special link destroyed for their own.
Connection listeners, we're talking frankly about relations between the United States of America and Saudi Arabia. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We invite you to join us. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, part of our continuing series, looking at countries in the Gulf, in the Middle East, as talk of a war in Iraq continues. With me on the program today, Professor Gregory Gause. He's a political scientist specializing in international politics and with a particular focus on the Arabian Peninsula and the Persian Arabian Gulf. He's director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Vermont. Prince Abdullah bin Faisal bin Turk Al Saud is in the studio with me. He's governor of the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority. He's the man in charge of trying to encourage foreign investment in Saudi Arabia. And Let's start with Iraq, Prince, if we can, because when the President of the United States talks about the benefits of a regime change in Baghdad, what he says, or what his people are saying, is wouldn't it be nice if, as a result of that, we were able to plant the seeds of an American-style democracy in Iraq, and that that could flower in that part of the world as an example to the other nations that that style of democracy can take hold. How's that heard in Saudi Arabia?
I think there's no doubt that nobody could deny admiration for the ideals of American democracy. I think if the United States want to occupy the high moral ground and tell people what they should have, people would expect it also to be responsible to make sure all its actions and decisions, particularly relating to the Middle East, to be also led by a balanced, open, fair, and just approach to the peace situation or the conflict that hopefully will be resolved by a just, peaceful way.
So, I mean, is it in your view hypocritical for the United States to take the position that it does in supporting Israel and then to speak about Iraq as...
Yes. There's very little credibility for what the Americans would like to do in that area because of their support for the Israelis that people feel are a threat to everybody's stability.
But more to the point, the idea of democracy in Iraq is also a direct challenge to the idea, the very principle of a monarchy that exists in Saudi Arabia.
I don't think so. I mean, democracy is not a technical process only. It is an attitude. It is and it's a more complex thing than just pretending to do votes. And it's a lot more. You have to make people feel. With regard to the Saudis, their political system, their socio-political structure, and their social fabric evolved from within at a time when they were almost outside world development. They've been in the modern world for 30 years, and it's difficult to expect any political culture to transform itself into something that has been well-tested and developed by people who have been doing it for hundreds of years. So it's always very difficult to prescribe things for other cultures. And it's not an easy thing. There is no doubt that everybody has a responsibility, and we in Saudi Arabia have a responsibility to transform whatever it is, be it the economic, social, or political situation in a society. How this will be imposed on other countries through military means or military occupation, that will be quite interesting to see.
Gregory Gause, the idea that Saudi Arabia has evolved the way it has into the modern world is something that a number of people in the United States challenge by saying, look, with the policy on women and the close ties to the Wahhabism, the severe form of Islam, that Saudi Arabia is not as far into the modern world as it should be, and that there's a sense in the United States that this should be encouraged.
Well, I think Prince Abdullah is right that Saudi development politically and historically has been somewhat unique in the region. They've never been colonized. It was an area that until the oil age was, except for the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, was rather marginal to world events, to world trade, to population movements. And it was within this rather isolated context that the Saudi political system developed. It has a certain logic and an authenticity within its own cultural and historical context that can't be denied. This is not an imposed system. This is not a system left behind by colonialists. But it is one that has been dealing with this question of, if you will, modernity, modernization for some time. And there are undoubtedly tensions, which the prince highlighted, between some of the beliefs, particularly the interpretation of Islam that is the common one, the state interpretation of Islam in Saudi Arabia. But it has been something that's been evolving. So I don't see this as something, you know, we're modern, they're not. I mean, if you go to Saudi Arabia, in terms of the outward elements of life, consumerism, cars, nice big buildings and roads and all. It's a very modern society. The question of women, the question of women's role in society is probably the biggest one that separates us culturally. But there are other things in which Saudis and Americans would find a lot of commonality between themselves in the way, in particularly in terms of the way they lead their life as consumers.
You know,
it's
we
a very Western-style consumerist
Professor,
society,
we,
very much like the U.S.
We came from another planet, jumped into right in the middle of the 20th century without parachute, with baggage, mostly good, I hope, and some bad, I'm sure. And it was really quite a huge transformation. And people cannot, you know, change so quickly. And each culture should be respected for its own contribution to humanity.
1-800.
I also think, if I could break in for a second,
that
there's a difference between the assessment of a culture. One might say, look, I don't like the way the Saudis treat women. They should have, women should have more freedom in Saudi society. And it's another thing to say that that should be a major part of American foreign policy towards Saudi Arabia. Because trying to impose those kinds of cultural changes from the outside, I think, can have a backlash. I think we have enough of an agenda of difficult issues at the government-to-government level between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, that if we added to that, well, look, you have to change your interpretation of Islam. You have to change the way you treat women. That'll make it much more difficult to achieve what I hope are more realizable goals in terms of cooperation against al-Qaeda, cracking down on funding sources from private sources within Saudi Arabia for these kinds of groups, and encouraging the Saudis to use their influence in the Islamic world to condemn the ideas of bin Laden.
Let's go to some of our calls, if we can. 1-800-423-8255. First to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Martha's joining us. Hi, Martha.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
What's on your mind?
I just wanted to first of all say a warm welcome to Prince Abdullah. I just returned from Riyadh in July. I've lived in Saudi Arabia for about 11 years, and hopefully we'll be going back in September. And I do, I come back every summer as an American with my children, and I do notice that the knowledge that Americans have of not only the Saudi area, but I think the Arabic culture in general is pretty much based on news reports, you know, where we share rather extremist points of view.
Martha, it's Dick here. Tell me what it is, the one thing that you find that you have to try and correct if when you come back to the United States, people have misconceptions about Saudi Arabia. What's the principal one that you're working on in conversation?
The principal one is the perception that all Saudis support terrorism. I think that's, whenever I say I've just returned from Saudi Arabia, people say, oh, it must be rough, and oh, what a pity. And I was fortunate. I actually was one of the few people that perhaps have had a chance to get out in Bedouin tents, to be out in the women's tents and that sort of thing. I don't know any members of the royal family. I only know everyday Saudis. And I found them to always be very gracious, very warm, and always questioning, I suppose, the American point of view.
I'm interested, Martha, when you say everyday Saudis, can you be a little bit more specific? Because part of the perception that exists in this country is that there are those who live a life of great wealth in Saudi Arabia and then all the rest.
Yes, there are those that live a life of great wealth. I taught at the British school in Riyadh. My children attended, both American and British schools. I was fortunate because My husband works with the Saudi military. I had a chance to go out during parties such as celebrations over the birth of a child or celebrations over weddings and meet Saudi women, Saudi children, not the men, but the women. Mm-hmm. And I would have never had that opportunity because most Westerners tend to live on compounds. And we isolate ourselves, and the Saudis tend to be isolated also, not through choice, just, I suppose, through happenstance.
Martha, thanks for your call.
Yes, thank
you. Nice to have your perspective. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts, and Gabriel's on the phone. Hi, Gabriel.
Hello, Dick.
Yep.
I'd like to say I think that this little friendship has to come to an end as rapidly as possible.
Why is that?
Saudi Arabian society is way too retrograde for America to have a safe or stable relationship with it. It's actually the only country left on Earth where you can be executed for the crime of witchcraft. Within the past couple years, a man from Sudan actually had his head chopped off in public because he was convicted of the crime of witchcraft, if you can believe it. But there it is, right on the news
now,
wires.
So Gabriel, this, when...
This is way beyond anything that we can work out. We've got to get our soldiers out of that country, get out of that country, start building solar panels, and just cut it off.
Prince, it's a point of view that Gabriel's expressing that you do here in this country.
Well, this is the law. Sometimes on some issues are not acceptable to the American public. I don't agree with the gentleman who called. I think whatever we have should be developed for the benefit of both, and we learn a lot from the experience of advanced societies. There are some laws in some countries that people don't, like. I'm sure there are some things in the United States people don't agree with. There are some laws where the practice is also different, like on racialism and things. And we must not give up. I don't think this is the right attitude.
That's my question, though. That's really what it comes down to. The very nub of this is how much difference do we tolerate nation to nation and maintain a relationship? Is there any point at which you say, here in Saudi Arabia, we just have nothing in common with those people in the United States. Let's move the troops out and live on our own. And the reverse.
Well, we don't have American troops. That is outside the UNIFIL or United Nations arrangements. In the past, against the Soviets and against all threats, whatever was required, Saudi Arabia provided with no problem at all. As I said, we didn't need even a marriage, let alone a prenuptial agreement, because we agreed on so many things. There is extremism in every society and many aspects of political and socio-political culture. If the Americans want to tell other countries that they should follow them and be like them, they also have a responsibility towards the world. I mean, if you want to have a big stick and use it, you have to also have big credibility. And the thing we really would love to see is that the American policy is seen as credible everywhere in the world. If some American politicians tell people that they know better, and at the same time do other things in certain regions that have no credibility at all, that causes a strong anti-American feeling. But we are keen to see the American image in our region, particularly in other places, to be a good one and a good picture, because I think that America has also something to teach the world, there is no doubt.
Gabriel, last word to you.
Yeah, I'm no expert on foreign policy, but there's one rule that I'm real comfortable with. You don't sell F-16 fighter jets to a country where people are still being executed for witchcraft. It's not a good idea, and it's going to come back to bite you.
It's an example that you used before, Gabriel, but the United States sells...
It's good, actually. I wish it would be applied to all people, all countries in the Middle East.
Sells F-16s to Pakistan and when similar problems exist there. It just... Where do you draw the line, Gabriel? I mean, I understand your sense of this, but where do you draw the line?
I draw the line around the Wahhabi cult that is causing people to be under threat of stoning in Nigeria.
So it's justice issues.
That is genocide in Sudan. Right. That is causing rape victims to be flogged for the crime of adultery in Pakistan. That is where I draw the line.
All right,
America,
Gabriel, I'm going to ask if I can...
democracy and start saying... tinhorn dictators.
You're breaking up there, Gabriel. I'm going to cut in here and ask Greg Gause to join us just on this particular question of justice issues, because that's actually one, Greg, which frequently gets public opinion whipped up. And it's not, we're not necessarily talking about Saudi Arabia here, but we use the example because the prince is with us.
Sure. I think that Gabriel's point is one that I hear all the time, talking to average audiences up here in Vermont, outside of the Beltway, outside of New York. And it's something that I think is just inevitable in the relationship. But the way I come back is always when they say, well, we should just break off relations with these people. And I always say, and then do what? I mean, there's still that oil there. There's still the common interest that we have in a world economy that works, that isn't that isn't slowed down by oil prices that are too high and in crisis, and that local economies in the West are experiencing reduced demand. The stability of the world oil market, it seems to me, has been proven time and again over the past 30 years to be pretty essential to our own economic well-being and the economic well-being of the world. And the fact is that, you know, 25% of the world's oil reserves are in Saudi Arabia. The other thing that I think is an interesting question to think about is the democracy question. And Gabriel said at the end that we should get behind democracy. I'm not sure that in a lot of parts of the Middle East we would like what we would see in real democracies, at least at the beginning. I think that most of these elections would be won by people who are much less friendly to the United States for a whole range of reasons, having to do not only with Arab-Israeli issues, but American policy on a number of other issues. And I think that we have to step back for a minute and think about what are our interests in this area, and how do they match up with our values? How do we resolve the tensions? Maybe we should speak up a little bit more to our friends in Saudi Arabia and a little more publicly about human rights issues on which we diverge, but always in the context of saying that we have this common interest and we want to work with you.
And when people do speak up, Prince Abdullah, and say, you know, from our perspective, we find this unacceptable, is that heard in Saudi Arabia?
Heard or hurt?
Heard.
Of course, yes. We have laws that are not easily changed. It takes time to get popular support for changes. It is something continuing as an effort. And, of course, we feel that sometimes cultural differences make feeling strong, like the gentleman Gabriel earlier on, and I don't blame him, you know, for feeling very strongly about these things. But he should, if he's really keen on studying this issue, then he should look at the fact that you have to have a balanced and treatment of these issues in an area like the Middle East. And he should get into it to understand the cultural background to all of this.
1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation with Saudi Prince Abdullah on the state of U.S.-Saudi relations. 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Prince Abdullah bin Faisal bin Turk Al Saud, governor of the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority. He's in charge of attracting foreign investment to Saudi Arabia, which obviously means a large dose of his responsibility is in managing relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Gregory Gause is also on the line with us. He is director of the Middle East Studies Program and a teacher of political science at the University of Vermont. Let's start out, if we can, in East Aurora, New York. Alan's on the line. Hi, Alan.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Could I ask two quick questions?
Go ahead.
It says Al-Qaeda is one of the principal aims is to get U.S. troops and weapons off of the peninsula, the Arabian Peninsula. I'd like to ask the prince, if we complied, do you believe that the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia could actually improve?
I don't think this relates to the foundation of the relationship. We've never had American troops unless it was necessary, like during the Kuwait crisis, and at times policing the Gulf when the Soviet threat was imminent through the activities in Iran before Khomeini and when the Afghanistan invasion took place in 1979. As I said earlier on, we were so close to the Americans, we don't need specific agreements or facilities. Everything in the country will be facilitated
But Osama bin Laden says that American soldiers on Saudi soil is an abomination, and people hear that. People believe him when he says that.
We have UNIFIL, the United Nations arrangements.
I know what the arrangement is, but what I'm talking about is the real politics.
Yes, but bin Laden uses all sorts of things just to get some excuse for what he's trying
but
to do.
But he has a constituency when he says these things.
No, not on the U.S. troops, because there isn't a big U.S. presence in our country right now, except the United Nations related to the no-fly zone program mm-hmm. in the south of Iraq after the Iraq-Kuwait thing.
Right.
For bin Laden, he will use anything that will move people to be more anti-American than before, like using the issue of American policy in the Middle East with regard to helping the Israelis against the Palestinians and the unbalanced view that the American politicians have. And this is a very popular thing to use because people, you know, have been watching the deterioration of the situation there. And everybody like that, any extremist, will use any language to look good in front of people.
It's Greg Gause here.
Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
Don't you think, though, that the American air wing at Prince Sultan Air Base south of Riyadh that flies the Southern Watch over southern Iraq, don't you think that the presence there does serve as a lightning rod for domestic public opinion feelings in Saudi Arabia? I mean, bin Laden, of course, exploits it, but it's there to be exploited. I think the questioner wanted to know whether if the air wing left, if things would be easier in the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and it is a good question.
Well, I don't feel there is a wide resentment in the public about Americans, because we've always had good relations with them, and the Americans were welcome, and we have hundreds of thousands over the years. Symbolically, maybe some people, because of the U.S. policy in the Middle East, might be more emotionally excited against anything American. But people are generally quite sensible about it, and we've never had a big problem. Nowadays, maybe because of the administration's view in allowing Sharon to do whatever he likes to the Palestinians, the resentment is growing against most things Americans. But I don't think it's will make a big difference about the air wing.
Alan, you had a second question.
What kind of financial aid is the Saudi kingdom providing to Afghanistan? Is it substantial?
We are major donors with the U.S. and the European Union and Japan and co-sponsors of the two economic conferences that took place. And we give quite a lot of aid. I don't know the number yet. I think it was about $400-500 million. And, you know, it's very important what many countries are doing for long term. We really must look at long term. And like on Iraq and other areas of conflict, we have a long-term role to play, and we must not damage that role for the sake of military expediency. And this is why on a number of issues we say, no, we cannot do it this way.
You know, I'm struck by the number of times in answer to different questions that you will return to the U.S. policy, the U.S. support of Israel. Is it, in the view of the royal family, in your view, really such an imbalanced position that everything needs to be seen in that light?
Unfortunately, it's not what the ruling family or a government or administration at home or other countries feel that matters for everybody. What is more important is the general public in the Middle East. 200 million plus people feel this is a problem. And friends of Americans like the Saudi government and other governments tell the Americans continuously that their credibility and everything they want to do is affected by this. Their unbalanced support for one side against the other is even affecting their credibility in other regions, because that is always used as an example.
Although the lack of balance on the other side almost seems to even things out. If you were to have a conversation about the appropriate policy on the streets of Riyadh or on the streets of Cairo, you would be hearing people say, you know, finish it, push the Jews into the sea, forget it, it's not working. I guess what I'm saying is that, no, it's there. Let's be honest about that. That there is such ill will there, that to say that there's imbalance on one side but not on the other is...
Well, maybe you need an expert to talk on this program about this at length. But
I guess I'm trying to understand just how much you see this affecting or impacting U.S.-Saudi relations.
Believe me, in the last 3-4 years, if it had not been for these scenes on the media, on TV, and seeing what's happening up and in between the Israelis and the Palestinians, between David and Goliath, or is it the other way around? It would have been totally different. Even I think those people would not have dared plan the horrible crimes that they implemented, because they really thought...
You're saying the terrorist attacks that took place against the World Trade Center towers were a direct result of U.S. support for Israel?
No. They were terrorists that would have done things anyway. But maybe they felt by doing it makes this big challenge that all the people in our area would rise and follow them. And this was actually a big mistake on their part. It is different from being religiously conservative to going with extremists who are using religion. And, you know, like those people here who were using nationalism to do things in the United States or in other countries. And there's confusion. There's big confusion between, say, like what somebody mentioned earlier on, the Wahhabi cult. It's not a cult. Wahhabism, we don't call it Wahhabism. He was a scholar at the beginning of the 18th century who came and said we should go back to the fundamentals of religions. And he talked about the unity of God and not worshipping trees and stones. The fact that certain people who followed his ideas or under the influence of his scholastic work on other issues happened to be rather austere and dour and about certain social issues. And they carry through right later on. It is not a sect, it's not a cult. And it is a bit like the Amish people who wanted to stick to their own socio-religious culture, but with a lot more proselytizing activism.
Well, the Amish people aren't hardwired into the White House, and the sense is that there is a much closer relationship between the Wahhabi clerics and the policy, the government policy.
Well, actually, by the way, in Islam in general, there is no sort of
separation,
church
indeed.
Structure or mosque structure. And it's loose in the sense of there's room for individualistic efforts. And this is why we get in confusing things in writings and utterings by these people. And people in the United States readily taking this as a representative of a wider political or public sentiment.
Let's go to Norwell, Massachusetts. Tom's on the line. Tom.
Hi, I'd like to comment as an American who thinks that the media campaign to bury the Saudis is a very dangerous thing. And I think it's pretty superficial because Saudi Arabia, in my opinion, has done a masterful job in balancing their roles as custodians of the two holy mosques and also the swing producer in OPEC who basically can have a massive effect on the Western economies, and you know, these are two very difficult issues to balance.
So, what do you think's behind it, Tom?
Well, I think there's a lot of domestic American politics behind it, to be honest with you, and I think also there's a lot of people who just don't want to go there and look and learn about Saudi culture. Unfortunately for me, I've been there 3 times. I've been there during Ramadan, and I'm just a typical American. I was raised middle class. And to me, my experience visiting Saudi Arabia during Ramadan was the most devout experience I've ever experienced in my life. I've never seen such an outpouring of love. Arab hospitality, I think, is something that, you know, people should learn about in this country. It's an amazing thing. And we continually just bury that region. We continue to bury the Saudis without even taking into consideration their responsibilities as custodians of the two holy mosques. I mean, asking the Saudis to allow the Americans to use their land as a base to attack Iraq would be like us asking the Vatican to use the Vatican land as a staging area to attack Italy. And people will never understand that, and people have to start understanding their responsibilities, because the eyes of the entire Islamic world are on the Saudis at all times with everything they do.
Tom, I want to thank you for your call. I'm glad that, to get your perspective. I do want to go to Greg Gause on something that has kept coming up in the hour, Greg, and that is U.S. policy in the Middle East as this great elephant in the bedroom affecting relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia. You travel there fairly often. You've been there recently. Is that the way you see it as well?
Well, it's always been there. There's always been that issue.
It's not new.
I think it's a bit more intense now, because as the prince said, you get the satellite television, you have a better educated population in Saudi Arabia, they have more information sources, and so it's more prominent. Dick, I was wondering if I could ask the prince something about his job as a head of the investment authority.
Go ahead.
We've got this big project, these big proposals for Western and international energy companies to come into the kingdom to develop the natural gas reserves, and the project seems to be stalled. It seems that if the prince could tell us something about that, because if the gas deals don't go through, it does seem to me that the environment for foreign investment in Saudi Arabia will be damaged.
I don't think so, because it's a special program rather than general investment situation or the environment of investment. As you know, there is a very new law that is very popular with investors. Our organization hopefully will be able to achieve good results in promotion. Since the law was introduced and licensing started a little bit over 2 years ago, we've had about $12 billion. And actually, by the way, half of it is from American companies. And so that's encouraging. And general investment in the country by locals also increased. You know, the program symbolically, to me anyway, is very important, and to many others. But it's not really that huge, and it's not that tremendous. We hope to hear something in the next few days. I think the problem was in balancing profit and risk and the appreciation of those two elements. But the essentials, I don't think, have been diminished, and the need for that, I think, will be interesting.
Is this Saudi Arabia's principal outreach at this point, the request for foreign investment?
Well, it is very important for us to try to encourage people to look at the Saudi market as an investment market, not just as a big importing market. You know, Saudi Arabia is the biggest market for the G7 countries outside mm-hmm. their own trading bloc. And people have known Saudi Arabia for big contracts, huge jobs, and things like that. Now it's different. Now we are sellers, not buyers.
Prince Abdullah, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Prince Abdullah bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud is governor of the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority. Gregory Gause, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Mr. Gause directs the Middle East Studies Program and teaches political science at the University of Vermont. Connection listeners, to continue the conversation, you can find us on our website. We're at www.theconnection.org. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR. We're funding.